First, I just wanted to thank Samira, Saba, Charles, and many of the other organizers, the graduate students, for putting together this event and for asking me to speak. A while back, I had decided to step away for a while to get a taste of a different kind of political world, that of nonprofits and NGOs, which also has its own tribulations and dangers. But the world of academia had become fraught with dangers that may make many professors question or censor what he or she may say for fear of persecution or harassment, particularly if one is not tenured yet. But knowledge production as an institution is an important part of manufacturing consent for hegemonic and imperial projects. But it is also, I continue to hope, a part of resistance and questioning consent. So I'm very glad to be part of a panel with committed researchers with the title Questioning the New Middle East. I thought I would start by reading a quote from two women activists who were members of the Women's Association of Hezbollah. This was gathered when I was doing my research in 2001 in South Lebanon. And I thought I would share this quote simply because there are a lot of similarities as to what it is that they're saying back in 2001 to what is actually happening now. And also because it sort of reflects on some of the concerns and the issues that the West has of understanding, and that she suffered from so many things. She produces and gives with strength and anfuan, chivalry. And she is a qanwa, content and satisfied woman. She bears and suffers the brunt of events around her, and that pushes her to work, progress, and look for ways to create awareness, tawaiya, among people on behavior and attitudes, like now with the issues of landmines. Again, the issues of the landmines come up. She's a very strong, active, and courageous woman. She gives her son to liberate the land that she lives in, and all this is due to her faith and her personality. The martyr's mother gave her children for the land. There is sadness, of course, as she lost her loved ones, but the land is precious, and her faith pushes her to give even more. Because we are a people who do not accept to neither live in humiliation nor kneel down, we have to improve this world for the generations to come. We see the result of those sacrifices. This blood and this resistance for the South was freed. Southern women played a large role, as she was the one supporting and nurturing the resistance, raising children to be fighters. She can give in all different fields of society, and she does. End of quote. As it is close to impossible to do any kind of justice to Lebanese all too complicated history in this very short period, I will simply provide a brief context of Israeli-Lebanese relations historically since the creation of the State of Israel in 1948, focusing particularly on some watershed events. This will help illustrate the political and regional context within which Hezbollah was created. I will then discuss the history of Hezbollah, its structure and transformations, its various political and civil institutions, the nexus of resistance, and the role that Hezbollah plays in Lebanese politics and society. I will address very briefly, given that some of the other speakers have already addressed that, the attempts to destroy Hezbollah as a resistance movement in Lebanon via diplomatic and not so diplomatic means, culminating in the failed attempt of this last war. The creation of the State of Israel was a hostile act against not only Palestinians, of whom 80% became refugees overnight, but also against neighboring countries and others who, like Palestinians, identified as Arabs. Lebanon was a very recent creation then, having just been formed as the Greater Lebanon in 1920, gaining independence from French mandate in 1943, although the French troops didn't leave until 1946. In 1948, Lebanon lost 7 villages and gained a state of continued worry about the expansionist policy of the State of Israel. Judea and Samaria, many argued, included part of Lebanon as well as Palestine. This was part of the propaganda. Lebanon's water resources were always in need, and for years to come were being stolen by Israel. Save for arms disagreements here and there, Israel has not defined its borders. It is important to make a footnote here about Lebanon's political structure that Saba already alluded to a little while. Lebanon is a confessional sectarian state where political power and public employment are allocated based on one sectarian's affiliation. The National Pact, many argue, an unbinding document, though it became consecrated in the Taif Accord at the end of the Civil War, divided power relations in the country between Maronite Christians and Sunni Muslims. This is at the end of the French Mandate of 1943. So as Saba said, the president has to be Maronite Christian, the prime minister is a Muslim Sunni, and the speaker of the house is a Muslim Shia. The hierarchy following into other domains as well. So it translates into also employment within ministries, etc. And even actually at some point entrance exams into universities. This was based supposedly on a French census done in 1932. Looking at the demographics of the country. There has never been any other census since 1932. The electoral system as well, it was based on confessions, whereas you can vote for individuals from different sects, you can only run for office based on your own religious sects, regardless of your own belief. This is an important consideration as it has always been a struggle in Lebanon, not only because it is a recipe for civil war, as it divides communities essentially by their sectarian affiliations, but also because it makes organizing to achieve power or political transformation outside this confessional system very difficult and almost impossible. Historically, there have been many movements, though, in Lebanon that were secular in nature, particularly around the Nasser era in Egypt. Southern Lebanon, being composed largely of disenfranchised populations, largely Shia, but also of all other denominations, and being at the forefront of the struggle with Israel was a solid ground for leftist mobilizing. The leftist movement, at least by the accounts of some, if not many, failed to materialize any concrete gains to create long-term institutions that can continue to build if you want a secular subject. The reasons for this are multiple and varied, starting with the continued defeats of 48 and 67 ongoing, and the heavy-handed contribution of the U.S. government in ensuring undemocratic governments all over the place in the Arab world, as well as economic considerations, short-lived periods of the national popular, etc. This background, thus, is important to understanding the ability of a sectarian political party like Hezbollah to grow and become today the largest political party in Lebanon. Going back to our brief timeline, 1975 was the beginning of the civil war in Lebanon. Israel played a significant role then. So besides the invasions and the occupations, Israel heavy-handedly played a role in internal Lebanese affairs. So it wasn't only Syria, as we continue to hear. Israel armed and trained various militia groups. There has been a historic link between right-wing political parties and militias, and the link is ideological as well as strategic, if you want. One of the civil war actors, for example, became later the Southern Lebanese Army, which was formed in 1976 and later acted as a proxy militia in southern Lebanon, guarding Israeli soldiers and settlements. In 1978, Israel occupied other parts of Lebanon after a bombing campaign of Beirut. And since 1978 onward, as well as before, Israel had had a free rein in South Lebanon to an extent. UN Resolution 425 demanding Israel withdraw, that was passed in 1978, was never observed. UN Peace and Monitoring Mission that had been in existence in southern Lebanon since 1978 could only record violations and witness, but had no authority to protect any civilians. The daily reality of those living, particularly in the south and under occupation, was one of daily tribunals with a brutal army that used various tactics and strategies to put the people of the south to its need. According to Munzer Jaber's amazing ethnography of daily battles and struggles of people and resistance in the south, Israel attempted to strangle the region into submission, which can in part explain the participation of some of the southerners in the southern Lebanese army. And this was done through not only military rule, but also various sorts of economic and siege and other tactics. Even though Iran's influence and support to Hezbollah is undeniable, yet Hezbollah is very much a Lebanese phenomenon and party, having arisen out of the context of the Lebanese political structure and a history of colonization, the resulting confessional system, invasions of Israel, continued marginalization of the South and the Shia politically and economically, and Syria's involvement in Lebanon as well. The precursor to Hezbollah was a movement established by the religious leader Imam al-Sadr, who found followers among the disenfranchised and marginalized in the South and the Biqa. Musa al-Sadr came to Lebanon as an Iranian, although he claimed Lebanese descent, in 1959, and he was soon elected as the chairman of the Supreme Shia Council for a six-year period. In 1974, in a rally in Baalbek, in the Biqa, he launched his popular mass movement, Harakat al-Mahrumin, the movement of the deprived, and its military arm, Afwaj al-Muqawama al-Lubnaniya, the Lebanese resistance detachments, or more known as Amal, which also means hope. Musa al-Sadr in 1978 disappeared while a visit he was visiting Libya, and he disappeared. Many argue his disappearance fueled the movement even further, mobilizing more members of the Shia sect. Within this context, and after his disappearance, another prominent religious theologian and political thinker rose in popularity and distinction, and this is Muhammad Hussein Fadlallah, who focused largely on educational and economic concerns, and was for a while thought to be the sort of spiritual leader of Hezbollah, although he's had several disagreements with them. Nonetheless, the period was characterized by a focus on the marginalization of the Shia community and attempts to mobilize and empower the disenfranchised through political Islam. During the Israeli invasion of 1982, and as some of the leaders of the different political parties were gathering to discuss what they were going to do, another meeting took place in Baalbek. And it was a meeting of different Islamic groups. Some of them were members of Amal that were not happy by what was happening in terms of the relation to Israel and the fact that except for a few places here and there, in 1982, Israel invaded Lebanon pretty quick, you know, within 6 days. So there wasn't much of a resistance movement against it, even though their militias were actually armed. The committee formed was known as the Committee of the Nine, and it declared its inacceptance of the progress of what's happening in Lebanon. This can be seen as the first Majlis Shura of Hezbollah. This was a coalition of Amal members that were not happy, as I said, members of the Dawah, Lebanese Dawah Association of Muslim Ulama in Lebanon, and as well the Association of Muslim Students. After a while, this committee of nine was replaced with a five-member committee called Shura Lubnan with unnamed members. The committee was expanded to seven, and finally in 1984, they decided then to officially use the name of Hezbollah, the Islamic Revolution in Lebanon, and the current yellow flag. In 1985, on the commemorative anniversary of the murder of Sheikh Raghib Harb in his town Jibshit in South Lebanon, Hezbollah issued its open letter manifesto, which outlined its program, and in it, it declared basically that it saw and addressed Israel as a hostile entity implanted in the Arab world. Structurally, thus, Hezbollah operates within a largely hierarchical framework, within an Islamic framework. A very important one is that of wilayat al-faqih, which is the concept of the guardianship of the jurisprudent. This concept was developed by Khomeini in his book, The Islamic Government, and came to be the guiding principle of the Islamic Revolution in Iran later. In the time, it is based on the idea that the last imam has disappeared, and since his disappearance while awaiting for his return, that the there is a local governor of sorts who is his own representative on some level in this earth. His authority knows no limit, and he is usually the most knowledgeable of the fuqaha or the religious scholars. So this was the Khomeini, and then later on it was followed by the Khamenei. And from the inception of Hezbollah to the present, the status and role of the concept of the wilayat al-faqih has remained an integral part of the party's intellectual foundation. Beyond its allegiance to the wilayat al-faqih, the party decided to have a public figure, the secretary general, which is elected on a three-year term basis, renewed only once. First it was Tfaili, then it was Abbas Musawi, who was assassinated by Israel along with his wife and infant child. And then after his assassination, Hassan Nasrallah came to power. Currently, the party has a Shura Council of 12 members, a political office, and a central command. Decisions are taken by majority and consensus. Upon, like I said, upon the murder of Abbas Musawi, Hassan Nasrallah came into power, and he is still in power. So part of the bylaws, if you want, had been changed to ensure his continuity in power. In 1989, when the first elections within Hezbollah were conducted, there were different committees created, different associations to organize the affairs of Hezbollah. I wanted to talk very briefly about finances, and because everybody and you know the general discourse is where does the money come from, and it comes from various sources. The obvious sources that everybody hears about is predominantly well, Iran and Syria are funding it. Iran has had a very long history of support of Hezbollah, in particular of the different institutions, but the exact amount of funding is not really clear. However, at the same time, more and more recently, Hezbollah has become more and more self-sufficient in the sense that it has institutions, investments, business endeavors, and it also practices a Muslim notion of tax, which is the zakat and the khumus. Hezbollah as a resistance movement. To think of Hezbollah as a resistance movement, one has to address the arms and military aspects as well as other aspects of the struggle. Some call it an armed resistance, and some see it as a way to survive. In either case, it entails a process of subject making and institution building, particularly if it is to actually withstand such onslaughts as the latest attack by Israel. So, abandoning its earlier vision to create an Islamic state in Lebanon, Hezbollah worked on creating an alternative society with its own rules and infrastructures. This was so crucial in the context of South Lebanon and the southern suburbs of Beirut due to a very long history of marginalization, where the state has totally abandoned people and not provided any kind of resources. There are two different kinds of institutions within Hezbollah. There are ones that are directly governed by Hezbollah, and then there are others that sort of adhere to the same principles but are, in essence, independent. Some of these organizations include the Martyr Association, established in 1988, that essentially provides for the families of those who die in the struggle. There is an entity called Jihad Construction, Jihad al-Bina, established in 1984, that has focused since 2000 and even before, and right now is actually rebuilding the country. There has been several educational institutes, including at least 12 schools, educational centers, and as well as universities. Media has been a significant component of Hezbollah's work in print, radio, and television. And at the same time, there is hospitals, clinics, all of which, by the way, had been utterly destroyed in this last war. Given the current talk in the U.S. media, and I'll just do this last point and then end. So given the current talk in the U.S. media and politics regarding having the U.S. and other democratic entities come in and provide funds to somehow tilt the balance so that people will actually prefer to or adhere to the new Middle East that the U.S. is actually proposing locally. It is important to really look at the relationship between Hezbollah and its constituency, not one of direct instrumental relationship. The culture of clientelism is very much alive and well in Lebanon, clearly outlined in the history of Lebanon, and has been sort of had more recent manifestations in the Hariri phenomena, as we like to call it in Lebanon, of often buying votes, getting jobs, etc. Hezbollah has a large membership and even larger constituency. The relationship is symbiotic as local leaders live among the people of the same economic status. Hezbollah institutions provide for their constituencies by way of satisfying the needs and ensuring the continuity of their neighbors, friends, relatives, and their own. This is not to claim that somehow Hezbollah leadership is devoid of power aspirations, but to stress the qualitative difference in the type of relationship built between leader and constituency, between cadre and supporters. On the other hand, various other political parties live in unreachable palaces behind doors and walls and distribute resources on election days. As such, Hezbollah did not, just a couple of points about it being an armed movement. Hezbollah played a very tangential role in the civil war in Lebanon, which has always been something that the Lebanese and others have appreciated in it. So except for a war between Amal and Hezbollah, it has never actually engaged locally. Its interest has always been declared as an interest in driving Israel out of Lebanon. And as such, when in the recent wars, reporters would go by and say, well, where are the fighters? You can't locate them. So unlike several militias in the history of Lebanon, where men would carry guns on their pockets and walk down the street, trying to provide protection by being thugs, in essence, this was never something that Hezbollah participated in. And those are all important markers in how the Lebanese public, and then in extension, the Arab world, actually sees Hezbollah. At the same time, the degree to which, especially during the war, Nasrallah kept talking about the importance of rebuilding and that everything will be rebuilt. He spoke to the people the language that they actually understood, that they could relate to. And in the second day after the ceasefire, Hezbollah cadres were all over the place surveying, recording, and trying to make sure that whoever's house was damaged gets actually reimbursed and start a process of rebuilding. And so this is seen as definitely an accountability issue. This is seen as leaders who are held accountable. And I will end there, and maybe with the discussion. Sorry. Thank you.